This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Tactics right here in the Situation Room. Whether you're joining us via YouTube Live or Facebook or Twitter or Twitch or Periscope or the terrestrial signal, if you're watching this on recording, however you're joining us, we thank you for being with us this afternoon here on Tactics, where speech isn't violence, tolerance isn't love, and disagreement isn't hate. Welcome to the program on this Thursday, last show of the week. More than likely, since I have to get out of here a little bit early, I'm contemplating using some of the content I didn't get to earlier this week and just doing a Friday show, but we'll see where that goes. It really just depends on how much we get done today, because I do have to opt out a little early today. That's why I'm starting the show about 30 minutes earlier than normal. But part of the reason that it is so important that I get this show in is because we have so much news to cover. This was a very, very big news day for the state of Alabama, and interestingly enough, even though this doesn't happen super often, the state of Alabama is in the national spotlight for our top news story this day, and that is that Jeff Sessions, yes, that Jeff Sessions, the one that is the former attorney general and former senator of the state of Alabama, has announced that he is running for his old congressional seat. So, for those of you who haven't kept up with the timeline, Jeff Sessions wins re-election, and then close to the, I guess it would have been 2 years after he wins re-election, yeah, because that's a six-year term. So, he is about to, just won re-election, very popular senator. He gets invited by Donald Trump to be his attorney general. He resigns his post as the senator from the state of Alabama, becomes the attorney general, and then a whole bunch of crap ensues. But suffice it to say, eventually we have Roy Moore facing Doug Jones. Doug Jones becomes the senator. And now Jeff Sessions is not the senator anymore because he is serving as the attorney general, no longer for the state of Alabama. Then, of course, there was a whole bunch of hullabaloo. Trump lets him go in a very public and demeaning way. And now he's saying, might want to run for my old Senate seat again. So he's not even taking just a Senate seat from the state of Alabama. He would be reclaiming the Senate seat that he gave up when he handed it over to the governor's discretion, then Luther Strange, then Doug Jones. And now he's saying he might get back in the race and win his Senate seat again. This is fascinating from a political standpoint, but because since Sessions waited so long to announce, and he is expected to make the announcement today, this is supposed to happen tonight on Fox News, according to several reliable sources. The Washington Post has reported that Attorney General Sessions plans to announce his run on Thursday night on Fox News and has already hired a consulting firm. So he hasn't officially announced yet, but basically all the cards are on the table. Several sources have confirmed that he is going to announce a run, and he has already hired a consulting firm to handle his whole campaign. So he's getting in, unless he's just playing some kind of gigantic elaborate prank and he's going to go on Fox News tonight and say that he's not running, which I just do not see happening. All the tea leaves and more are there. He's going to run. And this is just, I mean, it's mind-blowing how this shakes the race up. Because we already have a very crowded field. We've already got Representative Arnold Mooney. We have Secretary of State. We have our Secretary of State, John Merrill. We have Bradley Byrne, who is the representative from District 2 of Alabama. We've got, oddly enough, leading the pack right now. We have Tommy Tuberville, the former head coach at Auburn University, and we also have, running in this race, Roy Moore, who lost the last time. This is, I mean, you couldn't put together a season of whatever reality show, Big Brother or Survivor or whatever your favorite reality show may be, and come up with a stranger cast of characters than the ones we've got now. And I'm not saying that they're all bad or anything like that. I know that it sounds like I'm casting them all down. I'm really not. I'm just saying it's a really interesting mix. You don't have a lot of cookie-cutter, similar-esque characters. They're all incredibly unique. in the Republican primary for this Senate seat. And now you have Jeff Sessions. I mean, it really is almost like a TV show. It's like the guy, the character that used to hold this place left for a while, and now he's coming back really late into the game. Surprise, season two has a twist. I mean, that's almost what it feels like. And with this really crowded field, you're going to have three major opinions that are going to shape people's opinions on whether or not they'll vote for Jeff Sessions. Now, frankly, I don't know how many people are going to vote for Jeff Sessions. This is something that I'm going to speculate on, but I got to be honest, I have no idea. I never thought that people in the state of Alabama would turn on Jeff Sessions the way that they did when the president was going all over national TV badmouthing him. And because of that, I feel like my predictions on this subject are probably not going to be great. I'm going to do my best. I don't think anybody really knows, which gives me a little comfort because it doesn't mean that I'm not paying attention. It just means that I'm like everybody else and having a hard time predicting the voters of the state of Alabama. So I think really what's going to happen, and these are the three major opinions that I've heard on Jeff Sessions and whether or not people would at least consider voting for him again as the Republican primary. Just about everybody that I've talked to on the right says, oh, if he's running against Doug Jones, it's no question I vote for Jeff Sessions. So I'm not going to stay on that question just because I don't think it's one that's really up in the air. I think that if Jeff Sessions winds up as the nominee, he not only beats Doug Jones, he beats him by 10, maybe 20 points. Like, I don't think it's going to be even close. But Jeff Sessions right now, entering the race as the potential nominee in the primary, that is interesting because we don't know when he's running against other Republicans how he stacks up and where the voters of Alabama are going to go with this. So I've got a couple of thoughts here. The first major opinion that I have seen is basically my opinion. And there are other people sort of that pay attention to politics that have voiced this opinion to me as well. Sessions was a great senator, great AG, wouldn't hesitate to vote for him. Doesn't necessarily mean that they are going to vote for him. In my own case, I haven't made up my mind yet. I'm not really sure whether I would vote for Jeff Sessions over somebody like Secretary Merrill, over Bradley Byrne. There's a couple of different reasons for that, but suffice it to say, I am willing to vote for Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions can win my vote, and frankly, it's not a very long trip. He would not have to do a ton of convincing for me to say, you know what, pull in the lever for Jeff Sessions. I want him to be the Republican nominee. I'm not saying that I'm there yet. I'm just saying that it's not going to be a long trip. Jeff Sessions has to do very little work to win my vote. And there are a lot of other people in the Republican circles, especially the ones that are really influential, that have really paid attention to Jeff Sessions. They know that he's got a solid conservative voting record, that they're exactly where I am. He was a great attorney general. He was a I don't know why I keep trying to say secretary. I guess it's because John Merrill's on my mind. He was a great senator, and I think he'd be a good senator again. So check that one off the list. The second opinion here, which I think is going to be one that's very, very common, and I've heard this from a lot of people. They typically will say, well, you know, I like Sessions. I think he was a great senator. I think he was a terrible AG. Now, I'm completely opposed to that. I think he was a phenomenal AG, and that's not to demean Attorney General William Barr, because I actually think William Barr's done a fantastic job too. So I'm not trying to make a comparison here. I'm just saying I think Jeff Sessions was the best Attorney General we've had in decades. This is an opinion I do not share with these people, but there are a lot of people that look at Jeff Sessions in the state of Alabama. I've heard this, I don't know how many times, that they say, you know what, he was a really good senator. I don't like the job he did as AG. And a lot of this is because of the bad mouthing that Trump did over and over and over and over again. Then it has tainted their view of Attorney General Sessions, but they're willing to at least look at him and say, but I really liked him as a senator. So yeah, I'd vote for him as a senator. That's a pretty common stance, and I think that the people that are in that boat, those are the people that have a good chance of securing him the Republican nomination. Now, I don't know if they will. I'm just saying that if there's enough of those people that vote for him, I think that Jeff Sessions has a good shot. He'll have to convince the people of the first opinion, including myself as well. But if he gets that vote, I feel like that may be the most common stance of the people of Alabama. I mean, they voted for him over and over again. He served in Congress for like 30 years. So they obviously like the guy. It's just a question of how much his job as attorney general, which a lot of Alabamians disagreed with, I happen to not be one of them. I think he did a great job. The question is, how much did that taint their overall perception of him? Because there are going to be some people that hold that opinion that say, yeah, I could pull the lever for Jeff Sessions. I'm good with him being my senator. But they could also say, I really don't like the job he did as AG, and there's other conservatives in this race, and I might pull that lever for them. And the people that are incredibly loyal to Trump on that, they're going to look at somebody like Tommy Tuberville, whose campaign strategy seems to be, say, I like Trump every 10 seconds. Some of those people are going to look at Tommy Tuberville and say, well, he's more pro-Trump than Sessions, so I'm going to go with him. I mean, it's unfortunate, but that's the truth. And so the question is, how many people in that camp that think of him fondly as a senator, but not necessarily as an AG, are going to be able to pull that lever? And then finally, this is the other major opinion that I've heard from people when it comes to Jeff Sessions in the state of Alabama. Basically, that Sessions is a traitor, he is the devil incarnate, and we should stone him to death for the sin of not being willing to break the law to cover Trump's behind. I mean, they probably wouldn't phrase it that way, but based on the way they talk about him, there are people that, I mean, just absolutely worship the ground that Trump walks on. He's a god to them. I genuinely think that they pray to Trump every single night. I don't think that that's an untenable position considering the way they talk about the man. I mean, he's really become an idol to them, and these people are not as rare as you might think in the state of Alabama. There's a reason it's the most pro-Trump state. And because Trump ever said anything bad about him or ever talked about how he disliked him, those people, they're done with Sessions. They don't want anything to do with him anymore. Let's go with a guy that's super duper pro-Trump. They're probably going to wind up going with Tommy Tuberville. And I think those people are a large part of the reason why Tommy Tuberville has right now a very commanding lead in this race. Now, whether or not the entrance of Jeff Sessions significantly shakes that up is interesting, but Sessions may be the only person that could jump into this race and actually cause problems for Tommy Tuberville, because I said a long time ago, it's Tommy Tuberville's to lose. I like Bradley Byrne. I like John Merrill. And as I said a while back, if you had to have me vote right now today, I'd probably vote for John Merrill. But the problem is Tommy Tuberville has such a commanding lead. I didn't see any path or avenue for him to be able to make that. So then that really, from a political standpoint, raises two questions. First, how many votes can Jeff Sessions siphon off of Tommy Tuberville? And the second part of that is, if he does siphon off those votes, do they all go directly to him and he becomes the new leader? Does it become a two-man race? And here's the really interesting one. Does he siphon off just the right types and the right amount of votes to make it competitive between him and Sessions and somebody else? So does this all of a sudden become, because Sessions jumps in and siphons off votes only from Tuberville and not really from any other opponents, does that bring a third place person in striking distance? And remember, this is a office that we had to have a runoff between Roy Moore and Luther Strange just a couple of years ago. So it is very possible, we have a recent memory of this, that we could have yet another runoff for the Republican primary, which is going to really be kicking up and starting on March the 3rd. So, I mean, it's really fascinating if you're a political nerd like me, the way that this shakes everything up. So then we have to ask the question, is Sessions the best man for the job? How are people going to answer this question? First of all, the man has a conservative record. Nobody can look at his record and say that he does not have a very conservative voting record. He is more conservative than a lot of the elected officials, both in the House and the Senate. Now, his voting record is by no means perfect. I've looked at different rubrics and different groups that rate him. Most of the conservative think tanks, you know, Heritage, Conservative Review, that kind of thing, they give him about a 75. So, you know, not setting the world on fire, but also not doing poorly. And that's a lot better than most even Republican senators do. He was definitely one of the more conservative senators while he was there. So he's got a really conservative voting record. He's got way more experience than anybody else at being a senator. There's absolutely no question about that. So he has that. And then another thing that he has that I think makes him at least competitive with Tuberville is that he has near universal name recognition. You see, so far, Tuberville is the only person in this race other than Roy Moore that has near universal name recognition. And the reason that that's not a great thing for Roy Moore is that Roy Moore has a lot of recognition, but a lot of that recognition is negative. I don't know how much of it is going to be negative with Sessions, and that is going to greatly determine this, because he may be the only rival that has a lot of positive reception in the state of Alabama, we'll have to see, that also has really high name recognition like Tommy Tuberville does, and name recognition is everything in the state of Alabama when it comes to politics. Now, here are the downsides. These are the reasons that Sessions may not be the best man for the job. And these are concerns that I share. I'm not trying to puff up Jeff Sessions as some perfect candidate. I think that he has some weaknesses. First of all, his age. And I don't think that the voters of Alabama think of age as being much of an issue. I mean, we went very, very hard for one of the oldest presidents that has ever been in Donald Trump. You also have to keep in mind that our governor is freaking Kay Ivey, who's 170 at this point. And so I don't think that age is going to be as much of a deterrent for the voters of Alabama as maybe it would be in other states. But I think it's still at least a factor that we need to consider. Now, this one is going to be more problematic, and it kind of goes along with his age. He is seen as part of the establishment. I think that you could make a solid case that he's really not, that he kind of bucks the establishment, that he doesn't really fall in line with a lot of the conventional wisdom when it comes to Republicans, the consulting class, as it were, when it came to things like illegal immigration and a lot of other issues. Jeff Sessions did kind of march to the beat of his own drum in a lot of ways, but he's still more conservative than some of your cowboys out there when it comes to the Senate. Like, he's not as conservative as a Ted Cruz or a Mike Lee or a Rand Paul, but he's at least out of the establishment enough that some people, like myself, see him as not really being establishment. He's got some establishment ties. I'd put him somewhere along the lines of Marco Rubio, somebody that he's kind of a member in good standing with the establishment, and the establishment doesn't hate him, but the conservatives also don't hate him, and so he has kind of broad appeal, which I think is something that has helped him have such a lengthy political career. And I think a testament to that is the fact that he supported Trump as early as he did. Like, you have to remember, Jeff Sessions was the first major political figure to endorse President Trump. And that is a testament to the fact that this is not an establishment guy. Sometimes he goes outside the box and does things that are a little bit against the conventional wisdom. Normally, they're things that I agree with. But the point is, people might see him as establishment, but I really think that you could make a good case that he's not. And when it comes to him compared to the other candidates, I actually don't think he's the best candidate, at least just right now. He, like I said, he doesn't have too far to go to prove that he may be, at least for me. But I certainly don't think that he's the worst. I mean, you're looking at the field. I would definitely vote for him over Tommy Tuberville. I would think about it with Arnold Mooney, but the truth is that doesn't matter much because Arnold Mooney is polling so low that he's basically a non-factor. So, I mean, Jeff Sessions wins that one pretty easily, regardless of what I think. Then you look at him versus Bradley Byrne. I think that you look at their records as far as how often they vote conservative, they're pretty similar. So with Bradley Byrne, I think he's kind of neck and neck, maybe even a little bit better because he already has experience in the Senate. There's already people in the Senate that know him. He's going to be more effective early on. So, you know, there's that. I think the only thing, the most compelling reason that I've heard thus far from people as to why Jeff Sessions should not be the nominee is they want some fresh blood in there. And that is 100% understandable. Sessions has been there a really long time. Maybe it's time for him to pack up and retire and bring somebody new in. That's a perfectly legitimate argument and one that I'm sympathetic to. I don't think it should be the only thing that we consider. But, you know, I see that and I say, okay, yeah, maybe a younger guy that's never held a federal office or has held a federal office but not a Senate seat makes a little more sense from that perspective. And if we're going to be a party that advocates for term limits and people not being in Washington too long, if that's one of the primary things you're looking for, you have to admit that Sessions does not fit that bill. So there is that to consider. Now, before I move on to this this next part, I did want to mention this because you may have noticed the title of this particular episode is Choosy Moms Choose Jeff. And of course, that's a play on the fact that Jeff Sessions is entering the race. And so I went with Choosy Voters Choose Jeff. And to do that, because I wanted to make sure I was spelling it correctly and that was the phrase and the way that it's worded correctly, the Jif peanut butter commercial, I looked up Choosy Moms Choose Jif, even though I'm definitely a Peter Pan man, just saying. Peter Pan crunchy, you can't beat it. Anyway, Peter Pan should send me like a free jar of peanut butter for that plug. But anyway, when I did that, I looked up Choosy Moms Choose Jif, and the first thing that popped up was a website called microaggression.com. And what I found on this thread that they had put up there about Jif peanut butter is that the social justice warriors that had found a microaggression in the Jif advertising campaign were upset at this and also Kix, the breakfast cereal, for saying kid tested, mother approved. They're saying, I guess Kix and Jif think that only moms buy food. Well, they're not the only ones that buy food, but typically, yeah. Like, the thing some people get outraged over just tickles me to no end. So I think maybe the best thing about this story is that I looked up that slogan, and that was the first thing that popped up. If you ever want a good laugh, if you want some entertainment, a little stress relief, go to that website and just look at some of the things that they're complaining about. You will laugh until you cry. The last thing that I wanted to mention before we move on is that, according to a New York Times reporter, Sessions may wind up facing some criticism from Trump. That was the headline that I saw, and I was like, oh, really? You mean Trump might have an opinion on something when it comes to U.S. politics? Wow, that's unheard of. But anyway, so the New York Times, I know they're stating the obvious. They're just doing their job. I get that. But I don't know, just seeing that headline made me chuckle. So this is according to the New York Times, quote, Mr. Trump sent word to Mr. Sessions through allies that he would publicly attack him if he ran. No surprise there. And Mitch McConnell recently approached Mr. Trump, asking him whether his feelings about Mr. Sessions might have improved. The president said he was very much still opposed to Mr. Sessions and would make that clear if he had to, according to a person briefed on the discussions. So the takeaway from this, Donald Trump has the emotional stability of a 13-year-old girl. And I get it. I'm not saying that everything he's done bad. A lot of the things that he's done, I really like. But let's be honest, he has the emotional stability of a 13-year-old girl. I mean, he cannot let anything go. He holds a grudge to the end of time. And once somebody has crossed him in his own mind, no matter how nice they are to him, no matter how much they try to appease him, that person is dead to him from then on, and he will never say anything nice about them again. That's just the way that the man is. And he believes that, for whatever reason, that Jeff Sessions has been disloyal to him. He hasn't. But that's really the way that the president sees it, and because of that, you are going to see if Jeff Sessions does indeed announce tonight, and I see no reason to believe that he would, and I mean, the evidence shows strongly that he will, that what you are going to see if that happens is President Trump coming out guns a-blazing. And I mean, that's really should be a surprise to no one. So speaking of some of the representatives in the state of Alabama, or at least the people running for them, there are some representatives in the House now that have come out and spoken about the Ukraine discussion. So we're going to look into that. Mo Brooks said the other day when he was talking to Mark Levin about the Ukraine call, this is a quote from Representative Brooks, I'm thankful The president is trying to ferret out corruption wherever it may exist. All right, well, you know, pretty standard, and I agree with Brooks on that. If we have corruption in a foreign government, as long as it is something that interests us specifically, then the president does have, maybe not necessarily an obligation, but he certainly has the right to look into that, especially when they're going to be using tax dollars that are provided by the United States of America. Now, that's an important distinction that I want to give out. I don't really see any hard conclusive evidence of a quid pro quo. Now, since this week has transpired, we have seen at least some people within the State Department, and I think one Ukrainian official that said this was understood to be a quid pro quo. There's nothing about that in the phone call itself. President Zelensky himself said that he didn't see it as a quid pro quo or that pressure was being put on him. The timeline doesn't exactly match up with that because what's happening there is they wound up pulling the aid when before the Ukrainians even thought of that being a thing, whether that was the reason for them pulling that aid or not. So there's several reasons to believe that there's not even a quid pro quo there. I'm not saying there's no evidence to suggest that there is. I'm just saying that the evidence is shaky at best, and it's really hard to prove intent with that, especially when the major players involved in this, which would be President Trump and President Zelensky, are both saying, no, no quid pro quo. I mean, if it were just Trump that were saying that, okay, the guy has a vested interest in believing that there is no quid pro quo, but President Zelensky would actually politically benefit from saying that there was a quid pro quo, because that would put political pressure on the president to allow his country to receive the aid no matter what. And so President Zelensky knows this and despite that actually agrees with President Trump in saying that there was no this for that. There was no exchange of a service for taxpayer dollars in the form of foreign aid. So on that one, I really don't think that you can make a conclusive case for that. But here's the problem. The Trump administration, early on, set this imaginary goalpost, and they're the ones that said it. This was not the media. This was not the Democrats. The Trump administration went out and parroted over and over again, no quid pro quo. Because there is no quid pro quo, there is no corruption. So they set that imaginary goalpost right there. If there was indeed a quid pro quo, and there are people now within Trump's administration, not deep state guys, but actual people that worked for the president, that were assigned by the president, that said they understood this to be a quid pro quo. And that is a mark against the president in this case. Now the president is having to backtrack a little bit. Maybe what he should have said from the beginning, at least for political expediency, would have been, yeah, there was a quid pro quo, but it was a quid pro quo that America has a national interest in ensuring that our tax dollars are used correctly and effectively and not just swallowed up by bureaucrats. And because of that, I wanted to make sure that this corruption had been handled. And the second part of that, and this is where I think Mo Brooks' statement makes the most sense, if the president were to come out and to say, look, I had to make sure that this was correct. I had to see if there was corruption here or not. And he has to make that case, not that, oh, I told him that I was going to get dirt on Joe Biden, which is, of course, what the Democrats are alleging. He has to go in it from a perspective of, I just wanted answers. Now, whether that resulted in dirt on Joe Biden or a prosecution of somebody else or with absolutely nothing to come back, just an all clear, that's all I wanted. So I was going to withhold the money until I got answers to these questions, not until they gave me dirt on Joe Biden. You see, because that's a completely different standard. As long as the president is saying, I just wanted them to look into it, and that was going to be what I wound up not holding the money up for, that's very, very different than, well, I was holding the money until they gave me something I could use against Joe Biden. See, that proves a whole different kind of intent. And that does fall within the purview of something that the president would be perfectly able to do, both from a rational perspective and from a legal and policy perspective. Both of those things make sense if that was the motivation. And proving that that motivation was anything other than that is going to be very, very difficult by the House or the Senate or a court. It would be very difficult to do that. So another thing that Mo Brooks said, the mainstream media are now, quote, the communications arm of the socialist movement in the United States of America. And he goes on to talk about how they were planning a coup and all this other stuff. I won't go into the full quote here. But here's the thing. If you were an actual, let's take the media and the names out of it for a second. I want you to look at it this way. If you were trying to create an insurgence within the United States of America, or any country really, it doesn't even have to be America. If you are a splinter cell, basically an organization that wants to fundamentally change the government of the country that you are in and remake it into your likeness, if you wanted to have a socialist revolution, you would need people that were in charge of communication. And that's true of any real political movement. And so imagine that that's the case. What would that communication arm look like? What are the kind of things that they would do? What kind of propaganda would they peddle out and how would they do it? Because I contend, and this is where I think Mo Brooks hits the nail on the head, that if that were the case, they would look an awful lot like the American mainstream media. Think about this, first of all. Would they be constantly rooting for the president's downfall at every turn, on every show? Would they constantly see things that they could potentially use against the president and constantly be pushing that narrative out there and using that just drumbeat after drumbeat over and over and over again? I mean, you would think that they would. Would they selectively omit any facts that look unfavorable to their party's narrative or their party's agenda? They would, and we see the media doing this all the time. Because they couldn't shut up, for example, about the transgender bathrooms, but you barely saw any coverage at all in the mainstream media of the incidents of sexual assault that happened in mixed bathrooms or mixed locker rooms. They don't report that stuff. That's just one example, but they are constantly selectively omitting details because they strike against the narrative that their party puts out there. Would it constantly blow things out of proportion when the president makes a mistake? Look, the president makes mistakes on a regular basis. He is an incredibly flawed, imperfect man. And even most of his supporters would have to admit that if they were being honest. But the problem with the media is that they're constantly overplaying their hand. Everything is the end of the world. Everything Trump is going to get us into some kind of nuclear war and destroy the world. Every little policy change that he makes is going to cause some kind of global warming nuclear holocaust. There are no small problems. And if you were a communication arm of a communist party or any political party really operating in to try to undermine the current government, that's exactly what you would do. Constantly blow things out of proportion to motivate people to make some kind of change. Would they only choose spokesmen that agreed with said narrative? Because I'm telling you, with a handful of rare exceptions, and the only one that I can think of off the top of my head would be Jake Tapper, and even sometimes he falls into this category. You look at the CNN lineup, you look at the ABC lineup, you look at the MSNBC lineup, ABC News, so on and so forth. Every single one of them are simpatico with the agenda. They did a survey, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, I believe it was, of all the different journalists and different media outlets that identified as Republican versus Democrat, and it was in the upper 80s, the ones that identified as Democrat. And so, of course, you would assume even if everybody were on the up and up and telling the truth and were genuinely trying to be objective, that at least some bias would seep through with such an overwhelming majority in one camp. And so, of course, when we know that there are, I wouldn't say all, but a lot of Democrats in the media that see it as their job to sort of push that narrative, of course you're going to get incredibly biased coverage. And so that's something that a communication arm of a communist party would absolutely do. And then finally, would it constantly launch personal attacks on the president's character? Because I would have to say yes. And this is something that the media constantly does. Over and over again, it's all we hear about how Donald Trump is bad with women, which, by the way, he is. They constantly criticize the job that he's doing, criticize everything. I remember watching a CNN segment where they were being critical of him because he got two scoops of ice cream after dinner. I kid you not, you can look the segment up. These are the things that go on. And so when you look at all this, you have to sit there and ask yourself, well, if Mo Brooks is right and it was the communication arm of the socialist movement in America, what would that communication arm look like? It pretty much lines up exactly with the mainstream media. And that's why I think Brooks actually hit the nail on the head. But not to be outdone by Mo Brooks, somebody from the other side of the aisle, our representative from Selma, Terry Sewell of the state of Alabama, went on Meet the Press to discuss the impeachment inquiry and everything that's going on in the Ukraine. So we'll go ahead and watch one of those clips of her right now.
Have you heard enough in your mind that the president essentially should be indicted for this? I mean, that's what an article of impeachment is. It's an indictment.
It is. But I can tell you that the evidence is mounting. I think that the American people should hear the testimony of Ambassador Taylor. We just heard from a war hero, Mr. Venerman, recently. And I think that it's really important that we get to the bottom of this.
All right, so a couple things there. First of all, and I wanted to point this out, she points out that their big star witness was a war hero. And based on what I've seen about the man's record, he is. I think war hero is an appropriate classification for that guy. But here's the thing, being a war hero doesn't make you infallible. And what I think is hilarious is the Democrats now pivoted towards this and tried to make it out as though this guy, well, he's a war hero, every single thing that he says must be true. We can trust everything that he says because, of course, he is a war hero. Does it give him some credibility? I guess so, but ultimately, it doesn't mean that he has good intentions, nor does it mean that he's going to be right on everything. Case in point, you remember that the Democrats didn't refer to, when John McCain was running against President Obama, they didn't refer to him constantly as a war hero, and whenever he said something that was dumb or inaccurate, they didn't say, well, you know, he's above reproach, he's a war hero, whatever he says must be true. And what I find incredibly disingenuous is Terry Sewell and the other Democrats acting as though, well, he's a war hero, we can't say anything against him, we can't be critical of him, we can't even really float the question out there, maybe his testimony can't be trusted. Now, I'm not saying that his testimony absolutely can't be trusted. Based on what I've seen, he is a concerned citizen that had some issues with the Trump-Ukraine call, and he is perfectly within his rights, and I think that if he does feel uncomfortable about it, he would be in the wrong to not come forward and talk about it. But nonetheless, we should also not give him some kind of false sense of infallibility just because the man happens to also be a war hero. Just like we shouldn't do that with any other war hero, regardless of what side of the aisle that they may be on. And so that's one of the big takeaways. There were three big takeaways from his testimony the other day, the big star witness that the Democrats called. First of all, he felt uncomfortable about the call. Oh, okay, that's fine. He, in other words, he felt uncomfortable about it. He felt as though the president actually was asking for something that was inappropriate from the Ukrainian president. Well, that's your opinion, and I think that we ought to take it into account. But I also believe that since we have the actual transcript, and we can look at it herself, that you may have a little more expertise and experience on this stuff, but ultimately your opinion doesn't matter, at least from a legal perspective, any more than my opinion. Or any more from the opinion of some guy just walking down the street as an American citizen. So I'm not saying we just discount it. But I am saying that that's pretty subjective and weak when it comes to making a case for impeachment. The second big takeaway was that the transcript was representative of the call. That's what he said. Well, if the transcript is representative of the call, then that kind of strikes against this Democrat narrative that, oh, that's not the real call, and all the ellipses and all of the parts that were left out of it, those show the really bad, nasty stuff. No. This guy who believes that the Ukrainian call was inappropriate is still the same guy that is saying, but it's not as though they're hiding the ball with the call. That is a representative transcript of the call. Maybe it has an error here or there, it's missing something, but the overall theme and tone and context, they're all there. And having the actual call isn't going to make a difference in what's going on here. Now, he feels what's in the transcript is enough to make him personally uncomfortable. He does not say that there is enough for the president to get in legal trouble, and that was actually his third point, which is, I feel uncomfortable about the call, but the president didn't actually do anything illegal. So their big star witness made three major points, one of which was merely his opinion, and the other two actually strike against the Democrat narrative. So I do find it funny that Terry Sewell is going on Meet the Press talking about how, you know, eye-opening this was, and how looking at that testimony, she's so sure now that President Trump should be impeached. And I'm looking at it and saying, well, the only thing that kind of works against Trump is the fact that this guy's opinion is that the call was inappropriate. But inappropriate is very different from illegal. And so that's something that really cuts against that. And you have to remember also, and I kind of mentioned this earlier when we were talking about Bo Brooks, even if there was a quid pro quo there, the fact that he was looking for corruption is a perfectly legitimate defense. It is a perfectly legitimate defense. Because here's the thing. Even if it was personally motivated, and to be honest, I believe that it was. I don't know if it was Trump's idea or Trump went along with it because Rudy Giuliani suggested it. But either way, I think that it was personally motivated, and I think that Trump's idea or Giuliani's idea was, okay, well, if we do this, let's just say that the quid pro quo actually did happen. Okay, so we're going to hold back this foreign aid unless he gets to the bottom of this deal. If he gets to the bottom of what actually happened in Ukraine in the 2016 election. The issue with that, and remember that Ukraine already has arrested and convicted four men in connection to trying to manipulate America's election. So it's perfectly reasonable to believe that that was going on in Ukraine in 2016. So with that in mind, you have to remember that even if it's personally motivated, that does not necessarily mean that Trump is acting outside of his purview as the president of the United States. Here's a great example. Let's say that you were the sheriff of a town. That is an elected office, after all. Well, as the sheriff, part of your job is to make sure that laws are not broken, and one of the laws on the books is that cocaine is illegal. Let's say the sheriff is out doing his patrols run one night, and he sees his wife and a suspected cocaine dealer hanging out with one another and being very all over each other, and he follows them and then sees that they go and get a hotel room. So the next morning, the sheriff walks in and says, okay, I want you to investigate this guy. I want you to get the stuff on him, and I want you to bring him in. That is personally motivated, but as long as the guy actually does still have reasonable suspicion that he is a cocaine dealer, it doesn't matter because it's still the sheriff's job to bring those people in. So even if there's personal animus towards the guy, and even if the reason for him wanting his deputies to look into this was indeed because he saw the guy that was taking his wife out, you know, even then, he's still not in trouble because he was acting within the confines of the law, even if it was personally motivated. You can't say that everybody that has a personal connection to a law enforcement officer, that person automatically gets a free get out of jail card just because they happen to do that and they shouldn't get personally involved. Like, even if this was personally motivated, even if in the back of his mind what Trump was thinking is, I'm going to get dirt on Joe Biden, as long as it's still within the national interest to get to the bottom of this matter, still technically he has not abused his power because he's still doing something that the country has an interest in. And that's really the defense that should be used here, and one that seems to be forgotten by Terry Sewell. What if, for example, a president decided that he was going to investigate a political rival and wiretap their phones and communication lines because he suspected that there was something foul afoot, that there was some kind of Russian collusion, let's say, between this and the president? Wasn't that exactly what Obama did? Now, I don't think that that was justified, and I've laid out that case many times, but whether you believe it was justified or not, most of the people on the left say, no, that was perfectly acceptable, that was okay, because there was a national interest in finding out whether or not this guy was indeed in bed with the Russians, which, by the way, at least with that sentence on its surface, I agree with. We need to find out if one of our candidates is in bed with the Russians, and if we have reasonable suspicion to believe they are, we should be investigating them. But you could also just as easily make the case that, well, Obama was politically motivated in spying on Trump. Well, yeah, maybe, but if you can prove that there was a national interest in it, and that he wasn't just doing it for the sake of getting dirt on Trump, well, then you're free and clear, and he still had the right to do it. Now, I believe that you can make a solid case for there being no reasonable, and that goes back to the case of the FISA courts. I don't think that there actually was a national interest in it. I think that it was a cooked up, manufactured, reasonable doubt, as it were, for the reason they had to wiretap and spy on candidate Trump. But the point is, as long as that is there, it's funny to me that the Democrats want to play this game where, oh, no, that was in the national interest, and whether or not there was a possibility that it was personally motivated, that just doesn't matter in that case. But here, well, there was at least the possibility that it was personally motivated, so that must be it. That's the only logical explanation for why Trump would have engaged in this. It's a complete double standard. Let's look at one other clip by Terry Sewell.
To me, I've seen my Republican colleagues twist themselves into a pretzel in order to defend the indefensible. I think this is about right and wrong, right and wrong. And I think the American people understand right and wrong. And I think that it's important that we give to them, let them hear for themselves the testimony. And I think that we've already been presented with a lot of testimony that has been leaked or been the opening statements have been presented that has a very damning case against the president.
All right, so there's a couple things in there. First of all, she's somewhat contradicting herself, or at the very least not calling out her Democrat colleagues. I don't think that Terry Sewell is nearly powerful or influential enough to be calling these shots. But she's saying, well, there's a really good case against the president, and I think that the American people should see all of the testimony against him. Okay, I agree with that. I, Caleb Colquitt, am agreeing with you, Terry Sewell. I think that that is an appropriate response to that. The problem is, she's saying, well, you know, there has been evidence that come out that has been leaked. Well, now, wait a second. If you're in favor of us seeing all the testimony for ourselves and making our own decision, why aren't you out there beating the drum saying, let's make this public, let's keep it out there in the open? Now, granted, in the past week, the Democrats have been a little bit better about that. But at the time of Terry Sewell making this comment, and frankly, still to some degree, a lot of this has actually been handled behind closed doors, and then they're strategically leaking only the details that makes their side look good. That's not the way this is supposed to work. You can't just say, well, there's a really good case against the guy, and if you want a good case for it, look at the strategically leaked evidence that we specifically put out there to make him look as though there is a case for this guy being guilty. No, let's look at the full thing and look at everything in context and then make a decision. Let's not make a decision based on the little tidbits that have leaked out into the press over the weeks that people like Adam Schiff have strategically just placed breadcrumbs for the media to find. Let's make this public and out in the open. I'm fine with that. What I'm not okay with is Terry Sewell acting as though, well, that's really all you need. and acting as though, well, I'm the one that's for transparency. I'm the champion. I think that the American people should see all of it. But, you know, they have really seen all of it because they're getting the bits that the Democrats have been leaking out. No, that's not good enough. I want it to be transparent, too. But Terry Sewell is saying, well, let's opt for transparency, and then saying, well, you really have all that you need to know because we're strategically just leaking those things out there for you. You got to hold one standard to the other. Now, if Terry Sewell had gone on and said, you know what, it's not right that the Democrats are keeping so much of this behind locked doors, I think that it should be out in the open, then I give her a hand on that. And I would have at least respected her courage for doing so, but of course, she is not going to do that. Because I find this really important. I find this really important to the central theme of this entire story. I want you to notice something. The Democrats are strategically leaking information and trying to keep as much of this behind closed doors as possible. They want to keep all the names out of the public eye, and they just want to spoon feed you little details bit by bit that make their side look good. What is just about everybody on the right saying to you? Go read the transcript. Go read the original whistleblower complaint. Look at everything that you can. Which one is more likely to be the side that's trying to cover something up? Is it the people that are saying, go read the original documents and decide for yourself? Or is it the people that are saying, no, here's a little bit of information. Okay, here's a little bit more information. And we want you to get all of that through the filter of the media who is on our side. Out of those two scenarios, who is more likely to be the one that's trying to hide the ball from you? That's the question you need to ask yourself. Who is more twisting themselves into a pretzel, to use Terry Sewell's words, to try to give you the spoon-fed narrative that they want you to have? That's the difference in what we're talking about right here. If the transcript were so damaging, if the raw data were so damaging, and it was so bad, and it was so, you know, to use Terry Sewell's phraseology there, if it were such damning evidence, then why did Adam Schiff have to make it up? If it were so bad and it was so obvious that Trump was engaged in criminal activity, well, then why did Adam Schiff had to make up a fictitious reading of it just to make it make sense? Just to make it make sense that his side was trying to make this case. Why is that? That's the question that every single person should be asking right now. So I tell you what we're going to do is, because I'm going to be winding this down here in a second, we're just going to go ahead and go to the Daily Dose of Stupid.
Oh, you messed it up. You're stupid.
And today's Daily Dose of Stupid actually comes to you via our friends at AL.com. So there's an AL.com journalist. Because, as of course, as everybody in the state knows, unless you're some kind of weird hermit that doesn't pay attention to anything going on around you, in this state, you know that this weekend is LSU versus Alabama. And an AL.com journalist has blamed Trump for college boys sexually assaulting people. I'm not kidding. This is the actual story that's going on here because, of course, President Trump is going to be attending the football game in Bryant-Denny Stadium against LSU. So she is now saying that Trump is really to blame for boys in college sexually assaulting people. I don't know how, but this is her explanation. We'll go ahead and pull this one up. So this is Abby Crane, who is the, and I swear I'm not making this up, the women and gender issues reporter for Hale.com. Why they have a women and genders issues report, I don't know. But here's the tweet. Okay, I'm just going to say it. Remember when all us girls who went to the UA were talking to current UA girls about how guys seemed more aggressive / emboldened post-16 election? Please be safe this weekend. Do not leave your girl alone. Buddy up. Don't take drinks from strangers, etc. All right, so a couple of things on this. First of all, I see the title of her job as being demeaning. Like, you have her on there and she's only allowed to report on or take stories about women and gender. I don't even know what that means, but Anyway, I find that somewhat offensive to suggest that a reporter should only be handling that particular, like, well, why do you even have somebody assigned to that? But anyway, so looking at the tweet, first of all, shouldn't women pretty much do this all the time? It's regardless of who's in town or when a football game's going on, whether it's not even football season and you're not even a college student, you should never be at night leaving women by themselves to, you know, just walking down a dark alley or something like that. And you also shouldn't be taking drinks from people that are already open. Like, that's a general rule. That has nothing to do with the president being in town. You should do that all the time. But what's hilarious is she's suggesting, essentially, that men are more apt to sexually assault or rape or do other untoward things towards women because President Trump's in town. In other words, President Trump's mere presence makes men want to sexually assault women. Like, there's guys at the bar in Tuscaloosa looking around like, you know what? I wasn't going to, you know, just slap that girl on the butt, but Trump's in town, might as well, right? That's not how this works. It's so absurd that that's the thing that her brain comes up with. And I think this is a classic case of Trump derangement syndrome, that you think that just Trump just being in town, men are going to be more likely to sexually assault you. I don't see how anyone gets to that place mentally. But anyway, the thing is, men have been acting like jerks around women since the dawn of time. Not all men, obviously, but men have been, you know, trying to sexually assault women. That's been something that has been a running theme in the human race since we've been around. The idea that Trump suddenly caused this, or that men were emboldened or more likely to do so, it's just so stupid. How does anyone even come up with that? Now, even if that were the case, that I still don't believe that you could make a case to prove that President Trump getting elected or being in town is going to cause men to act more irrationally and more sexually aggressively than they would under normal circumstances. But the question is this even true? Did men even get more aggressive or emboldened? I still don't think that you could tie that back to President Trump's election, even if you could prove that that were the case, that like after the 2016 election, all of a sudden guys at the University of Alabama became sexual assaulters. I don't think that you could ever make that case and draw a correlation between those two, or a cause between the two, even if you could show correlation. But the question is there even correlation? Like, can you show that after 2016's election that these men got emboldened? Well, it's interesting because I found an AL.com article, the very publication which she works at, that seems to suggest that that's not the case. In fact, granted, we don't have data on 2016, 2017, 2018. That data just hasn't come out yet. I'm not sure why. I guess nobody's done a study on sexual assault at colleges. But I found some data from AL.com, of all places, and they were citing their source, of course, but this came from them initially, for the National Center for Education Statistics, that show, and this is a headline from AL.com, on-campus sexual assaults climbed 52% in 3 years at Alabama colleges. Now look at that. It jumps from 23 to 32 to 35. That is a substantial jump. 52% is a lot. Wait a second, look at the years. 2009, 2010, 2011. Well, that's weird. There's this sudden spike in sexual assaults. Who was the president in 2009 and 2010 and 2011? Because, oh, right, it was Obama. That's weird. There was a spike in sexual assault at the University of Alabama right after Obama got elected. Huh. Well, the only logical explanation is that President Obama being in office was causing men at the University of Alabama to sexually assault women. I mean, that's the logical conclusion, right? No, that's stupid. And it's stupid to suggest that Trump getting elected had anything to do with it as well. And by the way, let's actually look at another graph here real quick that shows the stats. It basically breaks down the graph that you just saw. This is a breakdown by school. So if you're looking at the University of Alabama specifically, you'll notice there's a jump from 1 to 9 in 2010, and then it goes down a little bit to 3 in 2011. So still pretty minute at the college. By the way, just a side note here, this kind of breaks that myth that 1 in 5 women are sexually assaulted at college, because you're looking at the University of Alabama. If that were true, even if you're looking at their highest year of 9, that would mean there would be only less than 100 people at the University of Alabama. I'm guessing there's substantially more than that. But anyway, these are the stats that break them up. And by the way, I'm not trying to make a comparison here, because this is, of course, horrible no matter where it takes place. But I'm just saying, when the state was experiencing a 52% increase in sexual assaults, I want you to notice what university did not see an increase. Auburn. So I'll just leave that. You can do with it what you want. But it's so ridiculous to blame a politician for this. Is sexual assault a real problem at colleges? Absolutely. There's a reason that colleges, and I work at one, there's a reason that we work so hard to make sure it does not happen. But the idea that because somebody got elected, that now men are going to be emboldened to do stuff, that's just so patently absurd. Look, we all know that AL.com and its affiliates have had a very distinct left bend for a really long time. This is just one more piece of evidence to it. Well, actually, it looks like I'm a little bit past time here. I've got to get out of here, but thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. We'll have to forego the chaplain's report today. I promise I will get to that soon. We'll do it at another time. I may be able to pull off doing a show tomorrow because it was such a busy week, but either way, we will be back soon, and we look forward to seeing you again. Stay the course, friends.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.